re-inauguration of our It From Qubit virtual seminar series to have Tom Faulkner from University of Illinois, who will be telling us about QNEC. And let me just say one thing about, if you want to, you should definitely feel free to interrupt Tom and ask questions. In fact, I think that'll be helpful for him so he doesn't just feel like he's talking to himself. When you do that, you unmute your mic, and then I think you should tell Tom who you are, because he doesn't really see you, and so just say your name before you ask your question. And then when you're done asking your question, or rather when you're done with the exchange with Tom, you know, his answer, your follow-up question, et cetera, when you're all done with that and he's gone on with his talk, please don't forget to mute your mic again. Is anybody having technical problems that they want to ask anything about before we get started? You should be seeing Tom's slide on your screen. Any technical questions before we start? Okay, well, Tom, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Okay, thank you for the invitation to talk in this virtual seminar. I think this is going to be a very weird experience for me, so please ask questions, interrupt, so that I know that I'm not talking to my screen, just my screen. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a paper that we put out recently with my students, Srivatsan Balakrishnan, and two postdocs, Zuhair Kankar and Baja Wong. The outline is as follows. I'll motivate the quantum null energy condition, and then I'll introduce the average null energy condition. Basically, recently there were two methods that we used to prove the average null energy condition, two independent methods, and it wasn't entirely clear how these two independent methods were related. What we're going to do is put them together, and that's how we're going to get the quantum null energy condition. More technically, we're going to introduce some function f of s, and we'll study various properties of it, which will allow us to extract the QNEC. Now, you might ask during the talk where we came up with this function f of s, and basically it's related to causality and entanglement surfaces in ADS CFT. And then I'll introduce I'll talk a little bit about the calculations that we did. We sort of had to invent, well, maybe not invent, but we needed to come up with some methods to attack this problem using defect CFTs and the defect operator product expansion. And then I'll talk a little bit about generalizations and conclusions. Okay, so the quantum null energy condition. Basically, you should think about the following question in quantum field theory. The energy of any given state in a quantum field theory is positive if I subtract off the vacuum energy. Now, that's a trivial statement. But then it's possible that locally you can have negative energy density, which then integrates to something positive in some state, but locally it can be negative. And there's some natural question, which is how negative can it be? What constraints are there on that? And it's an interesting problem, in particular when you take that quantum field theory and you couple it to gravity, because if you have negative energy, then it's sort of like having negative mass, and you can do things with anti-gravity, you can do some really weird stuff. Okay, so there's some constraints that it should satisfy. And the quantum null energy condition is an example. So for example, that's what I've said here. If we study a classical field theory, then it's natural to look at something which is the null energy condition, which is just to take a local expectation value of the local stress tensor in some null null directions. So u here is going to be a light-like coordinate. And if you look at that in, say, a scalar field theory, then it's always, you know, something squared, and that's positive. It's trivially positive in a classical field theory. But quantum mechanically, we have to normal order this operator. There's some subtractions that happen. And as a result, the positivity, you lose this positivity result. And in particular, you can have expectation values in the quantum field theory where the stress tensor TUU is arbitrarily negative. But the question is, can you bound it by something? And these authors, a couple of years ago now, came up with a nice conjecture which bounds the null components of the stress tensor by something related to the entanglement entropy. So the entanglement entropy is some non-local quantity. It's generally believed that you can't bound the stress tensor by something local. So it's non-local. But what this is here is it's the entanglement entropy of some region A where the entanglement cut, the boundary of A, passes through this point Y where you're interested in the stress tensor. And then you take local variations of the entanglement entropy in the null direction. So I'm not going into details what this is because in the talk we'll define it slightly differently. So the reason these authors came up with this conjecture is comes from general relativity. And so basically the first motivation for studying the quantum null energy condition is it's something that you learn from gravity about quantum field theory. So it's a statement about quantum field theory, but by coupling that quantum field theory to gravity and demanding some nice properties of that gravitational in the semi-classical limit, then you come up with this conjecture. So the basic story is that gravity focuses light. It does not anti-focus light. And the way to see that is to study this Rachadori's equation, which tells you about the dynamics of null hypersurfaces. So think about some co-dimension 2 surface here, which I've drawn like this, and then shoot light rays perpendicular to that surface, and that defines some kind of null hypersurface. And the dynamics of that surface is governed by Rachadori's equation, which if I impose Einstein's equations, is determined in terms of the stress tensor of whatever quantum fields you have around here. And so what is theta? So theta is the expansion of these null geodesics. And you can think of it as the extrinsic curvature of this surface in some direction at some point here. So it's a local quantity. You can also think of it as the variation of the area of this co-dimension 2 surface if I move the surface slightly in this null direction. So the fact that gravity focuses light is the statement that the change of this expansion should be negative. And you can see that from Rachadori's equation because you just have negative quantities here as long as the TUU is positive. But of course, in quantum mechanics, we can have this negative energy here, and so then light rays can be anti-focused. And so this is somehow violated semi-classically. So the question is, Rachadori's equation is used to study to prove various deep theorems in general relativity. There's the singularity theorems. There's the second law of black hole thermodynamics, the statement that the area of black holes should always increase. And this follows from Rachadori's equation, but now it's violated. You might ask what replaces these things. And the natural thing to do is to notice that, well, area is in gravity is like an entropy. There's an entropy associated to areas and there's an entropy associated to just thermodynamics. And, you know, there's some second law that applies to areas and a second law that applies to thermodynamic to matter. How are these things related? Well, the natural thing to do is add them together. And then that defines something called the generalized second law. In more modern languages, instead of using thermodynamic entropy, use entanglement entropy, where you think about this co-dimension 2 surface as defining an entangling surface. And so we have some quantum fields reduced to some region, which is this green region here. We have some entanglement entropy associated to that. And then we take that and we add it to the area of that surface, and that defines some generalized entropy. And so now what you can do is and what these authors did is they went and looked at various things which depend on the area in gravity, and then just replace the area with the area plus the entanglement entropy. And that leads to a conjecture which is meant to replace the focusing conjecture, where you basically replace the expansion, which used to be just the derivative of the area, with the derivative of the area plus the entanglement entropy. And so instead of the regular expansion being the rate of change of the regular expansion being negative, which was violated quantum mechanically, maybe this quantum corrected version satisfies some generalized constraint, which is that the rate of change of this should be negative. And now if you take the flat space limit, you set theta to zero, you set the shear to zero, then you come up with the quantum null energy condition. So you get this second derivative of the entropy and the stress tensor from the Rechiduri's equation. Okay. The second motivation comes from a really nice paper by Jason Kohler and Stefan Leichenhauer, where they showed that the quantum null energy condition in holographic theories, in theories with gravitational dual, an ADS-CFT, the quantum null energy condition actually follows from causal properties of the Ryu Takenagi surface or the HRT surface. The particular causal property that you're talking about that they used is entanglement wedge nesting. So you can understand that as the statement that if I have some boundary region A, then there's an entanglement wedge associated to that. Let me just define that as the region between the entangling surface that falls into the bulk. So this is sort of the z direction in ADS-CFT, some entangling surface here. You can define the entanglement wedge as the region between A and that entangling surface. And if I take some region A and then I make it smaller, then the entanglement wedge in the bulk should also become smaller and should be contained within this. So something like this can't happen. What I've drawn here is not allowed. And this is a basic property of the study of bulk reconstruction, so in particular entanglement wedge reconstruction, which is the statement that the physics of the boundary region of the boundary region A should be encoded in the entanglement wedge. So if you have less information about that, then you should also have less information about the bulk. And so that's the second motivation for studying this quantum null energy condition, because it's sort of linking together many interesting ideas that have been studied recently in particular bulk reconstruction. We'll see there's physics of modular Hamiltonians, there's some relations to the chaos bound, microcausality and the bootstrap, and the average null energy condition will play an important role. And all of these things have in some way or another been used to attack the problem of the emergence of bulk locality in ADS-CFT from quantum field theory, which is sort of a deep question now. So just some reminders before I go on. The quantum null energy condition is a conjectured property of quantum field theory and no gravity. And we'd like to prove it for just general quantum field theories. We're going to prove it in Minkowski space, but likely the proof should extend to quantum field theories in curve space. And we'll work with general quantum field theories, but we'll demand that there's an interacting UV fixed point. And in particular, we're going to work when D is bigger than 2, so dimensions bigger than 1 plus 1. And we're going to start with the average null energy condition. So the average null energy condition is another way to find some positivity constraint on the stress tensor. So if the stress tensor is locally negative, then maybe if you integrate it, then you get something positive. The average null energy condition is a statement if I integrate it over a null geodesic. So just a null geodesic. I'm not integrating it over all of space, I'm just integrating over a null geodesic. Then the integral of TUU should be positive. So in Minkowski space, so here's the Penrose diagram. Then I'm integrating over some curve like this, where you integrate in the direction of TUU, of the contraction of these indices. This, the Aboriginal energy condition, is the positivity of this quantity is also a prediction of general relativity. For example, if you demand that wormholes can't be traversed, then you should impose the Aboriginal energy condition for null geodesic along the horizon of some eternal black hole, for example. So this is something that, you know, natural property that you might expect in general relativity that you guess is true for quantum field theory. And of course, then there have been two recent ways to prove it in quantum field theory. One interesting thing about the Aboriginal energy condition is it's actually non-trivial even in Minkowski space. It implies bounds on CFD three-point functions, which wouldn't be known to exist otherwise. And CFD three-point functions are sort of basic data of the CFD. So the two methods that we recently used to prove the Aboriginal energy condition. So the first method I'll talk about is work that I did with Rob Lee, Onkar, and Paja. And the idea is to study the physics of modular Hamiltonians. So let me sort of set it up. Let's imagine we have some quantum field theory where the degrees of freedom, the Hilbert space tensor factorizes into the degrees of freedom associated to A and A bar. This is not generally true in a quantum field theory, but let's just take it to be true for now. If you have this, then you can produce a reduced density matrix for some region A by tracing over A bar with some state. So there's some state psi, and then you take the reduced density matrix and you take the log of it. And that's just what you mean by the modular Hamiltonian. Something called the full modular Hamiltonian is actually better behaved in quantum field theory and doesn't have this issue that you need to have this tensor product. And it can be defined as basically the difference of the modular Hamiltonian for A minus the modular Hamiltonian for A bar. So it's this operator here, and it's an operator that acts on the full Hilbert space of the quantum field theory. And one way to understand why it's better behaved than HA is that there's all sorts of UV divergences, just like there's UV divergences and entanglement entropy associated to the UV degrees of freedom in the quantum field theory close to the entangling surface. But in the full modular Hamiltonian, because you're doing the subtraction, these are sensitive to the same kinds of divergences and they cancel out in the subtraction. Now, the full modular Hamiltonian satisfies a nice positivity property. If I take some region B, if I take some region A and then I reduce it to a smaller region B, then necessarily the difference in modular Hamiltonians Ka minus KB should be a positive operator. The proof of this, you can prove this using relative entropy monotonicity, and I read about this in a paper by Blanco and Cassini. I'm not going to go into the details, but basically the important thing is that you can define positive operators using modular Hamiltonians. In a relativistic quantum field theory, the inclusion actually happens at the level of causal domains, not the space-like domains. So for example, if I have some causal domain, which is this wedge here, D of A, so you can think of this as the domain of dependence of some region A, which was the space-like cut, and this is the domain of dependence of some other cut here. But basically, these are just some causal domains, and the inclusion requirement that gives you a positive modular Hamiltonian difference is that D of B should be contained within D of A. And so in this calculation, we're going to specialize to psi being the vacuum state. And then we'll take two cuts. We'll take one A to be just a half space cut. So you take Minkowski space and you just cut it down a flat co-dimension two surface. In this case, the modular Hamiltonian of the vacuum just becomes the boost operator. So that's the operator that holds fixed the point in the entangling surface. So it generates some flow that looks like this, these arrows here. And then we'll take B to be some small deformation thereof. So this is some causal domain, which is just a small deformation of D of A, and it's defined by this null vector delta XU. So this is a vector pointing in this direction along here. And this is the case where we're going to extract the original energy condition. In particular, we used perturbation theory to compute the difference in these two modular Hamiltonians. And we wrote it as an integral. We found the difference was an integral over the y directions. So the y directions are, you know, I'm only drawing two dimensions here, but this is a d-dimensional quantum field theory, and the y directions are the extra d minus two directions, which you feel like are coming out of the screen. And so you get an integral over the y directions multiplying this stress tensor, which is integrated. So TU but it's integrated over this profile. And the important thing is that this profile depends on y. So the B surface, the B region, is defined as some small deformation of the A region, but it's sort of arbitrarily fluctuating, if you like, in the y direction. And so because this is arbitrary, I can localize this function to some point and extract the average null energy condition, which is then just integrated over a single GP. This is not such a crazy statement. If I took this to be a uniform cut where it's not fluctuating, then the modular Hamiltonian of this region is just a boost operator again. And the difference between two boost operators is a translation operator. In particular, in this case, it's just a null, it's the null momentum operator in this direction. And that's sort of trivially positive because the spectrum of the momentum, p mu of the momentum operator in the quantum field theory is in the forward light cone. So this is just, it's a sort of a trivial statement for uniform cuts. For non-uniform cuts, it leads to the ANEC. We computed these modular Hamiltonians using perturbation theory. Actually, it turns out that this answer is an exact result as long as you take the deformation in the null direction. This was proven in these papers here. And one way to understand it, or one way to go about it, is to use some fairly deep statements from sort of algebraic quantum field theory, where you can show that these modular Hamiltonians actually satisfy an algebra. It's this algebra, so it's the commutator of two modular Hamiltonians just gives you this difference. This is kind of trivial if these are just boost operators. This is just a trivial, this is just the Lorentz algebra. If B is now some non-trivial deformation which depends on Y, then this is sort of a non-trivial statement. One important thing is that this algebra is only true for the vacuum, for vacuum modular Hamiltonians. Later on, we're going to study an object which is made up of these modular Hamiltonians. In particular, it's going to be related to modular flow. So we're going to exponentiate these modular Hamiltonians with this parameter S. And then this object here, you can just show using this algebra, becomes a translation operator by some amount, which is determined by this parameter here. I'm just highlighting this because later on, we're going to talk a lot about this object. But we're actually going to study this object not just for the vacuum modular Hamiltonian, but for the modular Hamiltonian of a general state. In some sense, for the vacuum modular Hamiltonian, this is a trivial statement, and so we're interested in the effect of the non-trivial state on this. So the second method that was used to prove the average null energy condition was sort of microcausality. And this is the setup is basically, you know, I have my light cone here, U and V. I have two operators inserted, O and the blue operator O here and the red operator O here. And these are, maybe you can think of these as like probe operators. And because these are space-like separated, then these operators should just commute as an operator state. Okay, so now I can evaluate this operator statement between two different states. You could evaluate it between the vacuum, but then that's sort of trivial. But if you choose to evaluate it between some excited state, so the excited state here you can think of as being generated by a path integral. I've drawn, this is sort of the real-time section, and on sort of coming out of the board, I've drawn the Euclidean section. And so you can you can make states by inserting operators in the Euclidean section. Think of doing a path integral from minus infinity, and then you see this operator insertion, and then you get a normalizable state here, which then is what you're computing this commutator in. But you know, you have the bra and the ket, so you have two operator insertions. You have these operator insertions. So this is a four-point function, and the four-point function, of course, has been studied to death using the conformal bootstrap. So basically, this statement that these two operators commute turns into a statement about the correlation function, the four-point function, so psi or psi four-point function. And so we define some function f of u, and this function has some nice properties from which you can extract the average energy condition. I'm not actually going to go into too much detail about this because we'll go through it in our case in more depth. So causality basically it becomes a statement that for space-like separated operators, this function should be analytic. And the reason for that is that commutators you think of as coming from discontinuities across branch cuts. And so you only expect the branch points, the beginning of the branch cut, to arise when these operators are light-like separated. So as long as they're space-like separated, you're going to have an analytic function. The second property is that you can compute it. And you can compute it in a certain limit, which is non-trivial. It's this light cone limit, which I'll talk a bit about in the next slide. And the third property is some positivity property. So you can basically bound this function generally. You can give a general bound on this function. And all of these three properties together allow you to extract to prove the average null energy condition. So let me talk a little bit more about the computability property. So the idea here is to try to compute this function using a light cone OP. So if I take two operators, if I take my two operators OO to be close to each other, then I can expand them in a sum over local operators, say at a midpoint between them. So that's what I've done here. Now there's two kinds of ways that operators can come close, right? They can come close in the Euclidean distance, but they can also come close in the light cone distance if I make them light-like separated. And this gives two kinds of expansions here. So firstly, we have the Euclidean OPE, which if you like, follows from, so U and V, sorry, I should have said that U and V are really the separation between these two operators. So in this picture, I have U, this is the U separation, and this is the V separation. So in this picture, I have V much smaller than U, but if I take U of order V, then the dominant operator that you get in this expansion is the operator with the lowest dimension. So you get some primary operator. But now if I take the light cone OPE, where I think of V as being much smaller than U, then if you look at this expression up here, then the dominant operator is actually the operator with the lowest twist. So that's the lowest, the operator with the smallest value of delta minus L, where L is the spin of the operator in the UV plane. So an example of an operator which has very low twist is TUU. Because it has the two U components, it has spin 2, and it has dimension, it's the stress tensor, so it has dimension D, so the twist is D minus 2. You can have lower twist operators from scalar primaries, but they're not really important. There's a way to subtract them out, so I won't discuss them from now on. But the interesting thing about this is that this is not the only operator that dominates in this limit, but you get a whole bunch of operators which have the same twist. That's because if I take a U derivative of this, then it increases the dimension by one, but it also increases the L by one, and so delta minus L stays the same. So in this limit, where you take V to zero and you hold U fixed, then you actually have to just resum all of these operators. And so you get an expression for this correlator when you appropriately normalize it, which is 1. So this is a contribution from the unit operator. And then you get some contribution which comes from the sum over all of these lowest twist operators. Now, if I take U large as well, so U is still fixed but large, then that you know, that contribution actually simplifies, and you get an integral over the stress tensor, which is just the average null energy condition integral. So you have this AU here. This CT is just the coefficient of the stress tensor two-point function. It's just a number. It doesn't have to be big. But what's controlling this expansion is the V goes to zero limit. So it's this term here. It's minus UV. These are Euclidean separated, so that's positive. But as V goes to zero, this is going very small, and that's what's controlling this. And so, you know, the three properties that I just stated, analyticity then allows you to extract a U as some contour integral over F in a range where it actually can't be computed, but it can be bounded. So it can't be computed using this light cone limit. You enter something called the Reggie limit. But in that range, you can't compute it, but you can actually bound it using some positivity. This is this wedge, in particular, in this paper by Tom Hartmann and company. They used wedge reflection positivity. And then this allows you to prove the average null energy condition. Okay, so there's a natural question then, which is, how are these things related? And the quick answer to that is, I have absolutely no idea. I still don't really have any idea. So instead of that, we're just going to combine them. So remember, for the modular Hamiltonian discussion, it was important that we had this inclusion property. So that's the property that this wedge is contained within this wedge. But I can turn this around, and actually that all that says is that the domain of dependence of B should actually be causally disconnected. So I'll write that using this commutator language from the domain of dependence of A bar, so the complement region A bar, and so that's this wedge. So this should be causally separated from this. This is some it from qubit thing, so I have to mention Bob and Alice at some point. So we now have our observers, Alice and Bob. They're restricted to some wedge region, some Rindler region, if you like. Alice is over here and Bob is over here. But they're space-like separated, so all observables commute between these two regions, and so there's no way for them to communicate. So that's causality. But if we just talk about local operators, then it's hard to extract anything other than the average null energy condition using the previous method that I described. However, now let's allow for non-local operators. So then in principle, we should be able to come up with new constraints. And so we have our negative energy, that's our state psi. And so we're asking about what are the constraints on this negative energy. And so there's an interesting class of operators that we can use where we take the local operator that was used in the average null energy condition causality discussion, and we take that and we modular flow it. So what does modular flow do? Well, it takes the reduced density matrix for that region B, so Bob's reduced density matrix, and it evolves with, it conjugates this operator with respect to this. So it's like time evolution with the log of the reduced density matrix for this region. And similarly, Alice can do modular flow. And so these are two natural operators that we should demand commute, because this is an operator still in the region A bar, and this is still an operator in B. Now, it's important that the reduced density matrix here is for the state psi, so for the excited state. This is a non-trivial thing. That's the first thing to say. Secondly, if it was the vacuum state, then modular flow is just a boost, and you would just get a local operator. So this wouldn't give you anything new. this is what we're going to do. These are non-trivial operators. You know, maybe you can think of them as having support in the whole wedge here. So here is the setup again. So we have our two regions. Now I've drawn the y direction just to clarify things. Our discussion, we tried to be quite general. So we're sort of allowing for general surfaces here, for general entangling surfaces A and B. There's some properties that they need to satisfy. But you know, they're separated in the null direction along here by some amount. This should be delta XU. Okay. And now in this plane, again, we have our two operator insertions over here, blue and red. And then you, with this setup, we're going to compute the following function. So this function is going to be an analogous to the ANF function f of u. So let me sort of give some comments about this function. So here it is again. Firstly, you know, this is just somewhat going to be, this part is going to be technical. Later on, I'm going to try to motivate a little bit better where this function came from. So the first thing to note is that the full modular Hamiltonian annihilates the defining state. So this is the modular Hamiltonian with respect to the defining state. So it you can show that it's not using a Schmidt decomposition that it annihilates that state. So if I look at this correlator here, then you know I have my two operators inserted here, and then I have these two sort of exponentials of the modular Hamiltonian. But if I just look at this part of it here, then I can insert for free e to the minus kAs because kA annihilates the state. And then I use the fact that kA is a combination of the two density matrices. And then you can rewrite that as just rho A bar because rho A commutes with OA bar. And so you just get this. And this is just the modular flow thing that I talked about before. So this correlator is really a correlator between the two different modular flow operators, one in region A bar and one in region B. We're normalizing with respect to the vacuum modular flow for all of these. So actually, this is somewhat the normalization is trivial in the sense that you can compute these things. Here we're using the algebra of modular inclusions, and you can rewrite this as a translation operator. And we're going to study the properties of f. It's similar to this ANEC function f of u, where you make the replacement where u goes like e to the s. And this function f of s actually has very similar properties to the function introduced in this paper by Moldesena, Schenker, Stanford on the bound on chaos. They introduced the function f of t. So the three properties that I'd like to emphasize. So firstly, causality. So causality, again, is a statement about analyticity. In this case, basically, because we want those two operators, the modular flow operators, to commute, basically what that translates into is an analyticity statement about f of s for real s, because if they didn't commute, there would be a branch cut. More schematically, modular flow in this correlator is a little bit like time evolution for a thermal correlator. And so for a thermal two-point function, if you have a thermal two-point function, then you have then that function has some nice analyticity properties in a strip, in a thermal strip. You have some analog of the KMS conditions that apply here. And the analyticity in the strip, let me just draw it like this. So this is the S plane. This is the imaginary part of S and the real part of S. And the claim is that this function is analytic in this plane from minus pi to pi. If these operators didn't commute, then there would be a branch cut running along here. Okay, and so that's the basic statement of causality. And then you know you can be more sophisticated and use various theorems by Borchers and others to actually prove that this is an analytic function in the strip. So the thermal width is usually beta, but in this case it's just 2 pi. The origin of this strip is such that you know the strip is centered on the origin here. And the reason for that, roughly speaking, is because we have one operator in OB and then one operator in the complement region. Technically, these statements require the state to satisfy some niceness conditions. It should be cyclic and separating, which means that no operator localized to the region can annihilate psi. And it also means that if I take all of my operators in that region and act on psi, then in principle I can make any state in the Hilbert space. to arbitrary accuracy. Having something like this basically just requires a large amount of entanglement, and all reasonable states in quantum field theory should have this. In particular, the vacuum state has it because it has a lot of entanglement close to the entangling surface, a lot of UV entanglement. And if it didn't, then you would have something like a firewall. The second property that we need is computability. Again, we're working in the same ANEC light cone limit where we have these operators inserted at sort of plus or minus UV, but now everything is collinear with the entanglement cut. And we're sending everything sort of to some light cone limit here. And in that limit, you can show that this function can be computed. You get one plus a small correction where the smallness is again controlled by the kinematics of these operators, operator insertions. V goes to zero, sends this time to zero. This function can be computed. Sorry, it can be computed for arbitrary S, and you can calculate this in this limit. But then, if you additionally take S very large, then you project onto the QNIC. So you project onto the QNIC. So if you take S very large in this expression, you find that the term here is this Q term, which is an integral of the stress tensor between the boundaries of the two regions. So let me go back. So we get an integral of the stress tensor, TUU, integrated between here and here. And then the functional derivatives of the entanglement entropy with respect to null deformations for the two entanglement cuts, A and B. And so, you know, if I take the two regions to be very close to each other, this just projects onto the local stress tensor at TUU, and then this just becomes the second derivative of the entanglement entropy. So this is sort of an integrated version of the QNIC. So we computed this using a defect OPE, which I'll hopefully describe later. But basically, the most important term here is the one here. So the one is basically telling you that in this expression here, which is the ratio of these two modular flows, one for the state psi and one for the vacuum, modular flow is acting like vacuum modular flow. So for operators that are light-like separated to the entangling surface, the action of modular flow on those operators is just like the vacuum modular flow. And this is, I think, some intuition that people have had for a while, and it's appeared in various papers. And I think the defect operator product expansion that I'll describe later is a way to show that. right, and compute corrections to that statement, which are small. And the other thing is, the important thing in this expression is the e to the s term. So this term is actually growing, right? So S is large, but I should take S large and fixed, and then take V to zero, and then this is a small term. But if I take S large and hold V fixed, then eventually I'll exit the regime of validity of this calculation. The other thing to say about this is sort of analogous to this Lupinov growth that they found in the chaos paper, chaos bound paper, where it saturates the chaos bound. And the reason for that is that we're not really working in the chaos regime, which is we're working in this light cone regime, which is slightly different. The positivity property, I don't have a great intuition for this, to be honest. So what we do is we think of this function as an overlap between two different states, and then we just apply Cauchy-Schwarz to that. It turns out to be useful to do that along in this S strip along the lines, the imaginary part of S is plus or minus pi over 2, so along these dashed lines. And then along these lines, you can show using that the real part of F is less than 1. So that's the bound, or less than or equal to 1, I should say. So that is, this bound becomes that along these lines. And then, so roughly speaking, computability says we can calculate this function in this region. we can extract the QNIC from that computation as a contour integral along this curve here. So an expression something like this. And then we can deform the contour, because this function is analytic, to an integral over these dashed curves, where we don't have control over the function, except for the fact that we know that it's bounded. And then that's positive. So that sort of ends the proof. Now, let me give you a little bit of intuition. The first piece of intuition comes from actually just thinking about vacuum modular flow. So this is where we have this simple correlator here, and these are just boosts. So when we combine them, we get a null translation, and we can act with that null translation on OA bar. So that's this operator here. And the null translation is just by this amount. And so when I take S large, which is what I wanted to do, this term drops out, and I'm just moving this operator a little bit like that. The same amount as this distance here. But let's say I made a slight error, this is Bob and this is Alice. Alice was actually in causal contact with Bob. They thought that they weren't, but they made a slight error. And so there's a small delta XV here. So if I include that small delta XV in this computation, you could do it because these are just simple boosts. What happens is, instead of this small null translation, you get this operator moving out into this region, and the red and the blue operator become into causal contact. And in particular, this small error that you made gets amplified. So if I have a little error and I expand in delta X nu, then you get this exactly the same growing e to the s term times something. So that tells us that the QNEC thing that we found in the previous paper, the previous slide, is really some kind of a delay in the B direction. But what kind of a delay is it? Well, the answer actually comes from ADS-CFT. So if we think about the setup in ADS-CFT, and this comes from this paper by Jason Kohler and Stefan Leichnauer, then the basically, you impose this entanglement wedge nesting requirement, which I told you about before. In this language, it's just the following statement, that if I have these two domains on the boundary and they're space-like separated, so the commutators vanish, if you like, then the entanglement wedges, so the entanglement wedges are really the region, the causal region between the entangling surface and this surface on the boundary. So it's some wedge in the bulk. That's for B and that's for A. Then entanglement wedge nesting is the statement that if these commute, then these should commute. The question is, do they commute? Well, so can I send a signal from E from the entanglement wedge here to the entanglement wedge here? And so we try to send a signal. Here is our blue basic some probe, and you can really think of that probe as this O operator. So we have some high energy probe, it's moving, it has a lot of energy, so it's basically moving along a null geodesic. And it picks up a delay in the V direction. And the figure of merit, whether you can actually you can send a signal from this wedge to this wedge, is exactly the quantum knowledge. So it's it's exactly this quantity, QU, or minus QU. And the other thing I wanted to say here is that the entanglement wedge reconstruction idea is somehow related to modular flow. This statement originally appeared in this paper, this JLMS paper, which related the boundary modular Hamiltonian to the bulk modular Hamiltonian. So, if you have access to the boundary modular Hamiltonian, then you can just basically generate all operators in the entanglement wedge by doing something like modular flow in the bulk. And so there's some relation between entanglement wedge reconstruction and modular flow. And so that's sort of the motivation why we looked at modular flow for these correlators. I would say that we probably haven't completely understood the connection between those two things. More explicitly, you can compute the delay in advance. And it comes from two sources. One is that, well, this null geodesic is moving near the boundary, so the metric has some non-trivial profile, and you pick up a delay in the v direction as an integral over GUU, like this. There's also the fact that the entangling surfaces are moving as you move into the bulk in the Z direction. And so there's some difference between the V coordinate here and here. And you can do a Pfeffermann-Gram expansion on all of these quantities. GU just gives you the stress tensor, the null components of the stress tensor. And if you do a Pfeffermann-Gram expansion on the RT surface, then it turns out that the leading term that you get is really the functional derivative of the entanglement entropy with respect to the deformation. And this is the thing that arises in the QNEC. So these are the two ingredients in the QNEC. And you see if you add these two delays together, then you're going to get something proportional to this QU quantity. Okay. All right. So now I want to go through a little bit quickly, the computation that we did. And the first statement that I would hear and that I would tell myself is you can't compute that. That's difficult. The modular Hamiltonian is some highly non-local object. Computing modular flow with it should be really hard. But we made some progress here using some defect CFT methods. So I want to describe that to you. So let's focus on a simpler problem. So the problem is just computing matrix elements of the modular Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is sort of the first step that you do before computing modular flow. But this is enough to describe the method. How do we compute matrix elements of the modular Hamiltonian? Well, the modular Hamiltonian is the log of the density matrix. So you want to use some kind of a replica trick. So you make n copies of the density matrix, and then you take a derivative and you send n to 1, and then you get the log of the density matrix. So the trick is, as usual, is to find an analytic continuation. So you can do that. You can define some object which is true for integer n using quantum field theory path integrals and things like that, and then you have to find an analytic continuation. What we have here to compute this guy turns out to be a path integral on an n replicated space. So for each of these density matrices, you have one of your copies of your space, but because it's a reduced density matrix, you have a cut along the region that you're interested in. And then you're drawing those cuts because you're taking powers of the density matrix. Each of these density matrices has a two psi operator insertions, or a psi dagger operator insertion. Those are the state operator insertions. And because we're interested in the density matrix for that state, we really need one for each of these copies. So that means we have 2n psi insertions. But we're also computing matrix elements with these two operators inserted, so we need two of those. So here they are, here and here. And here are state operator insertions. So here, I guess I've set n to 3. So the end result is a correlation function with 2n plus 2 operator insertions on this non-trivial manifold that I've schematically drawn here. And one nice thing is that to compute the full modular Hamiltonian, you have to take the difference, remember, between log rho b and log rho b bar. And you can actually argue that to do that, you should just do some monodromy on this operator insertion. So it goes to another sheet. And when you do that and you do the subtraction, many cancellations happen. So it makes life a lot easier. Actually, there's an alternative way to think about this computation, and you view it as an orbifold computation in the n copies of the CFT. So if I just take n copies of the CFT, then that has a Zn symmetry, but then I can gauge that Zn symmetry. And that's a nice thing to do because then you get a nice sort of CFT living on flat space. So it's not living on this non-trivial branched manifold Mn here. It's just living on flat space. It only has one stress tensor because I've modded out by Zn. The operators are single valued in the presence of a twist defect. So the twist defect is what replaces the branch points here. So at the branch points, you get an operator insertion. I've only drawn two dimensions here. In higher dimensions, this is a co-dimension 2 operator. So it's a co-dimension 2 twist operator, and it comes about after you do this orbifold. And so it's inserted along the entangling surface. We have our state operator insertions, which just become local operators. You just get a tensor product of psi operators, and that's symmetric, so that's fine. The O beat, there's a slight technical difficulty here in that the O operator insertions are not overfold operators. So you actually have to add sort of a Wilson line between them for the gauge, for the ZN gauge theory. But that's a technical difficulty. There are various operator product expansion methods for entanglement using the replica trick, so using this sort of approach. There's one where you take the operator, the twist defect, so this is the entangling surface here, and you just replace it by a sum over local operators. There's one where you take two twists and an anti-twist and you bring them close together and you replace that by a sum over non-local operators. But this one is sort of has been done with it, I guess, where you take a local operator and you bring it close to the defect, to the twist defect, and you can then replace that operator by a sum of local defect operators on the twist defect. And so this has been used recently to discuss shape deformations of entanglement entropy and so forth. And the way I think of this is somehow in ADS CFT is this is the Z direction. When I take this operator close to the twist defect, I'm really seeing the fields on the entangling surface. In the bulk, right? So there's some dynamical, I'm not entirely sure how to think of this, but this is the picture I have in mind. Okay, so more technically, what we want to do is we want to do a defect on these two operators. So we have these two operators, the blue and the red one, and we want to just replace them with a sum of local defect operators. And there's two challenges to this. The first one is we don't know what the spectrum of defect operators is. So the in the presence of the CFT, the twist defect, then you define some defect CFT, and that defect CFT has local operators in it. We don't know what they are. And then the second challenge is computing these OPE coefficients for this replacement. Actually, the second part is not that hard to deal with. So basically, because this replacement is local, I can do it. I can do the same replacement on a much simpler setup where I don't have these state operator insertions, psi, and I have a flat cut. So in that case, I can make the same replacement and the OPE coefficients are the same up to some local extrinsic curvature terms, which we can actually also compute. But ignoring them, it's basically the same thing that is here and here. So then we can use this, we can write that as an equation and just solve for the beta I. In particular, if I insert some other defect operators away from this, then I can use if they're, say, primary operators, I can use the fact that you get this delta, Kronecker delta on the operator, on the operators to just explicitly extract the beta I. So the next challenge is to figure out what the defect operator spectrum is. And the way to do this here is, well, basically it's to think about the following problem. So I have a twist defect, so a non-local D minus two dimension operator, and then I have two local operators. So that's a two-point function in the presence of this twist defect. And then I imagine taking, so these are these two operators here, and then I imagine taking them close to the defect. And each one I get replaced with a sum over defect operators. Is OI hat, the hat will always denote some defect operator. And so if I knew what the two-point function is in the presence of this twist defect, then I would know, then I would be able to extract the spectrum just by taking a limit. And that's the idea. In particular, one nice thing you can do now is you can take this two-point function in the presence of the defect, and you can analytically continue that in N. So that's something that I worked out a while ago. Basically, you can do it because there's a conformal map which maps this twist defect, the flat defect, to hyperbolic space at some temperature. And so this is just related to some correlator, some thermal correlator on hyperbolic space, and that you can analytically continue. And so if you knew this, then you can extract the spectrum of twist operators. When n goes to one, everything simplifies. In particular, when n is equal to one, then this is just, there's no defect. The defect's gone. And you just have a two-point function, CFT, that's fixed by symmetries, so you know what that is. At order n minus one, well, you get something which is also fixed by symmetries, but because now as you move away from n minus one, then you get an additional insertion of the modular Hamiltonian for the vacuum. And so that's a known integral of the stress tensor. So you can write that as a three-point function. That's also universal, at least in the CFT. So we want to keep the operators in some light-like limit from the defect, so everything's collinear in some sense, and then we're replacing these by these defect operators. And we're really mostly interested in looking at defect operators which are made up of the stress tensor. In particular, we want the lowest twist operator. Those will be the ones that dominate in this limit. And so we're going to take our bulk operator, phi, here to be TUU. And then we're going to bring that close to the defect and see what operators we get. And well, when n is one, there's no defect, and we just basically get the same spectrum as was found for the ANEC. And so we have the operators with some fixed twist are just derivatives of TUU. But when you compute the n minus one corrections, well, a few things happen. So firstly, n minus one corrections give rise to anomalous dimensions for these twist defects. So you can compute that. That's one thing you can do. But a new thing happens for TUU in particular is a new operator arises. And this new operator I'll call DU. When n is one, you didn't see it. It has the same twist, it's D minus two, but now it has spin one. So before the spin was bigger than or equal to two, but now we have a new operator with spin one, and this operator is actually something called a displacement operator. So what is the displacement operator? Well, basically, if I have an operator insertion and I compute the divergence of the stress sensor, the stress sensor should be conserved, but in the presence of the operator insertion, you get some local violations of that. Now, if I have a defect, then I also get local violations of that. And you get an equation where the conservation of the stress tensor is related to insertion of this operator, which is this displacement operator. So you get a delta function localized on the twist defect, and then you get this displacement operator here. And the physics of the displacement operator is just that it moves around the defect. Okay, it's just something that moves around the defect. And you can do this for integer n, analytically continue it. When you take n to 1, you find that the one-point function of this new operator is really just the derivative of the entanglement entropy, the functional derivative of the entanglement entropy. Okay, so I called it a one-point function, but it's not really a one-point function in the original theory because it's a state-dependent operator. And that's why you get something like the entanglement entropy. But at this point, I'm going to stop with the computation, so I'll save you that. But we have all the ingredients. It's easy to see we have all the ingredients that go into the quantum null energy condition. We have the operators when n is 1, which is TUU and derivatives of it. So that'll sum up to some integral. And then we have these new operators, which are the displacement operators. And so those are the expectation values of those give these functional derivatives of the entanglement entropy, and that's exactly what appears in the QNEC. And so it's not hard to imagine that then you will get this. In particular, this was just for a single insertion of the modular Hamiltonian. You have to do a bit more work to compute modular flow. It's actually not that much difficult, which is a little bit surprising to me, but. Let me say a few words about this displacement operator. When you take these phi operators close to the defect, if they're spinning operators with spin bigger than or equal to two, then you always find these new operators. And so, these are some generalized displacement operators. I'm not entirely sure how to think of them. They're subject to something that we studied, which is this higher spin quantum null energy condition. I think they probably correspond to fields living on the Ryu-Takinagi surface, but I'm not entirely sure how to make that precise. And the one-point functions of these operators are always nonlinear in the state, just like the displacement operator. That's because they're the limit as n goes to one of one-point functions in the replicated theory. Okay, so let me wrap up. Let me wrap up with some analogies between the ANEC and the QNEC and some interesting places to go. So the ANEC, actually, I didn't mention this, but the ANEC can be proven in ADS-CFT using a causality property. And this causality property is this Gall-Walls property, and Aaron Wall and Will Kelly used this to prove the ANEC, which is, it's the statement that the fastest path between two null points on the boundary is through the boundary and not through the bulk. So this is enough to prove the ANEC in holographic theories. The QNEC version of that is really entanglement wedge nesting. It's this sort of more fine-grained version of causality. And you know, in the quantum field theory, then you can extract this generally, the ANEC generally, by studying this four-point function, and the QNEC can be extracted using this modular flow correlator. One interesting thing to ask about is, well, if you try to build in more physics of ADS-CFT into these computations, at least, so you have a large n limit and you have a gap in anomalous dimensions, then this correlator can be used to study bulk, more bulk physics, where you move further into the bulk. So remember, the ADS-CFT versions of these is happening near the boundary of the space. So what happens when you push that into the bulk and you get really interesting physics here? You get some Reggi limit related to high energy scattering in the bulk. And so the question is, what does that correspond to here? So I didn't have time for various things like local extrinsic curvature corrections. I was talking about CFTs, but this works for quantum field theories and a few other things. So let me conclude because I'm over time. So causality leads to the quantum null energy condition. I think the most important thing for understanding how this worked was some bulk intuition from ADS-CFT, even though the statement was a general statement. And the relation between modular flow and entanglement wedge reconstruction seems very important. And we had developed some new defect OPE methods for entanglement and various entanglement computations. And these methods, I think, are really sort of probing the RT surface near the boundary of ADS in any theory. Modular flow, I think this sort of modular flow is a promising approach to exploring the emergence of bulk locality in ADS-CFT, and there will be new things to come from it. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Tom.
Okay.
Thank you so much. So now we have time for some questions, and I guess I will start with one. First of all, can you hear me, Tom? Okay.
Yeah.
At the beginning, you said it was restricted to d greater than 2, and I saw a couple places where there were like d minus 2s in some of the formulas. So can you talk a little bit about if d equals 2?
Yeah, the twist operator spectrum is non-trivial because, you know, you have the Virasoro algebra, and so you have all of the descendants of the stress tensor. And it's related to the twist operator spectrum. So there's not this gap anymore. The lowest twist is 0. Did that answer your question?
My internet connection actually blanked out for most of that, but I think I got them in. But d equals 2 is actually harder. It's not.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
Easier.
I haven't thought about it, so I'm not really sure what the challenge is. It's just that there are new operators with the same twist. So you should sum them up.
I see.
But maybe it's not hard. I don't know.
I see. Okay. If anyone else has a question, unmute your mic, and then maybe if a lot of people do it at the same time, I'll call on people. We'll try that system. unmute if you have a question for Tom.
Yeah, I have a question.
Perimeter has a question. Go ahead.
Ted Jacobson, you said at the beginning that you assumed that you had an...
I can't hear anything.
An interactive...
Or at least they unmuted their mic. You can start your video if you want.
I'm not sure if you're going to see us because we're on the laptop, but we are projecting the room. So let's see.
I'm not hearing anything from perimeter. Oh, wait.
There's a video.
Your video turned on.
Yeah, so. Ted, can you repeat? Maybe they can.
Can you hear me?
Oh, Onkar unmuted. Do you have a question, Onkar?
Can I ask my question?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, good. So I just had a quick question about this function f of s that
yes.
you defined.
Yes.
So in principle, you could define it to be a function of two variables where you evolve with different times,
yes.
right? The,
yes.
the OB and OA bar. Can be evolved and
that's
with different types.
Yeah.
So is that not useful? I mean, is that just, I mean, is there a reason you just chose to pick?
Not really. I mean, we can do the computation for that function. It doesn't seem to have quite those right properties. I mean, but maybe something else can be extracted from it. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this thing just seems to have the rise. I think the fact that if you compose two boosts with the same amount, so with the same flow, I guess, or the opposite flow, then you get something which is just a translation for the vacuum. That's special to when the two module flows are the same. So that's probably important, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm.
Anyone else?
We'll try again. Can you hear?
Horacio?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
How do you compare your proof with the one for free fields? Is there any relation or can you connect them by the proof? I mean, the proof by boson wall and operators?
Yeah. I haven't thought too much about that, actually. I'm not sure.
They use in essential way.
Can you repeat the question, Tom?
The question is, can I relate what we did to the free field proof? There's a proof of the quantum null-energy conditions for free fields, or I guess super renormalizable field for quantum field theories. So the first thing to say is that our proof doesn't work for free theories for the same reason that it didn't work for theories too. There's a whole bunch of operators with the same twists because you have all these conserved currents. But I mean, that doesn't mean you can't just compute this modular flow thing in using other techniques in the free field theory. And maybe it's the same thing. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe you can relate these proofs, but it's not obvious that they're related. Did you have something more specific in mind, Tarashi?
No, my question was because in their proof somehow it was essential to divide the variation of the surfaces in the small pieces in the width, and that's why they cannot do it in two dimensions somehow. Because they needed this approach of
width.
So I don't see, maybe it's coming from the operator product expansion in your case, something like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not the geometrical stuff, right?
No, yeah.
What I mean, I think in their case, they cannot go to dimension two because they are using essential way this partition that something goes small with the area.
Yeah, they have
the perturbation.
Yeah. I'm not sure if those issues are the same. I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it would be interesting just to try to compute this modular flow correlator in the free theory without using this defect method. And then and probably you could do it and then see what it gives.
And what do you expect to have for quantum fields in Turing space? How do you expect to generalize it? Or?
Well, I think it's related. So everything, I mean, the nice thing about the quantum null energy condition is it's really quite a local statement. And the proof I think that we gave is quite local as well. So basically, one thing I didn't talk about is the extrinsic curvature of these surfaces. So we did some computation which allowed for extrinsic curvature, and then you have to correct. I mean, the quantum null energy condition sometimes is no longer true. Then, I mean, it's in some sense trivially true, if you like. So to do that, you have to recognize the fact that these OPE coefficients and the defect expansion can actually depend locally on the extrinsic curvature of the surface. Okay, and then once you recognize that, then you can compute that dependence. Now, I think in curved space, then it's just locally going to depend on the curvature invariance of the background and the extrinsic and intrinsic curvature invariance. And in principle, you could compute that dependence. And the idea is then you're just mapping that computation to the computation of what the RT surface looks like in the boundary theory in ADS CFT. So in ADS CFT, you know, you can study quantum field theories on curved space. You just have to change the boundary conditions on ADS, and then the RT surfaces have some more complicated profiles, and there's some corrections that you have to compute. And these have been studied in depth by the UCSB group and the Berkeley group in ADS CFT. And I think that this OPE method should just sort of model that.
Anyone else? Any other questions for Tom? Okay, well, we'll say thank you to Tom. First, let me say that if anyone has any suggestions or you want to nominate somebody to give a talk, or you want to volunteer yourself to give a talk, just send me an email. So now maybe what we're going to try all unmuting and then applauding for Tom. That's, we're going to see how that works. Okay. So unmute your mic and let's all thank Tom.